is Friday, July 8th, 2011 at the Mid-Atlantic Christadelphian Bible School. Our second class this morning is being given to us by our brother Simon O'Grady. His theme for the week is Daniel and His Story, and the title of today's class is The Golden Image in the Furnace. Brother Simon.
We'll put a version of it on the screen. And in verse 1 of chapter 11, we see this emphasis on building and unity. And as we go through this, I'll emphasize the unity words and the building. You see what they're doing. Genesis 11, verse 1, the whole earth was one language and one speech. So see, they're all unified. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. So just note Shinar. We're going to come back to that in a moment. And look at verse 3, the emphasis on us and we in unity. They said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, slime had they for mortar. They said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach to heaven. Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. But far from unity, this ended up in confusion, as God did it in verse 8. The Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore the name of it is called Babel, or Babel, or confusion, or Babylon, because God did there confound the language of all the earth and scattered them abroad. So we've got these founding principles. The Bible's very clear. When Babylon's founded, here's the principles. And I've arranged these all nice and neatly in a tower. See? They go up. Took me half an hour to do that. So these are the key principles of Babylon. Let us, it's all about unity of people trying to aggregate together into a community. We want to reach to the top, to the heaven. Now, when I was a kid, I remember thinking, whoa, man, build a tower up into the sky, up to the clouds. How do you do that? But it doesn't mean that. What it means is a tall tower whose top is where they would worship heaven, because they were heaven worshippers, of course. Make and build, they're creating three things they make and build, a name for themselves, a city, and a tower, and the goal is to achieve unity and cohesion of people. And so today, wherever you find the spirit of Babylon, you're going to find the same types of spirit. You go to New York City, you'll find pride, human-centeredness, making and building names, cities, towers. You go to Sydney, you go to London, you go to any major city on this planet, that's the same spirit of it. And people are attracted to cities, aren't they? Hordes of people because of its universality. So the spirit of Babylon, as established in Genesis, is alive and well today. It drives all the cities and the world today. Here's another passage from Daniel 4. It captures the same spirit. This is the king of Babylon who says, is not this great Babylon? I built it for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power, the honor of my majesty. So you see the pride and the focus of the spirit of man there incorporated in Babylon. All right, after Babel, or establishment of Babylon, people were scattered here in Genesis chapter 11. It's confusion of languages. And we find in Genesis chapter 10, so if you go to chapter 10 where it describes the different nations as they went out, we've got this division of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So chapter 10 goes, the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, to them were sons born after the flood. And the chapter all neatly divides into these three groupings, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So I see in verses 2 to 5, you've got the sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, Tiras. These were the isles of the nations in verse 5, divided in their lands, their tongues, their families, their nations. So we've got this story of how the people, the Japhethites, left Babel and began to generally move out to the west. So we have this picture here, and you'll see way up here, hopefully in the mountains, if I can see it, way up the top there, I can't reach, but actually I can if I do this, eh? No, got to get closer. Mount Ararat's right up the top there. The Japhethites sort of went up north and out towards the west and dispersed here in Genesis chapter 10. Then verse 6, you've got the sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan. And in verse 8, you get to this guy called Nimrod, son of Cush, who it says in verse 8 is a mighty one on the earth, a mighty hunter of animals, and it says in verse 10 that Nimrod was the guy who founded Babylon. So you'll read in verse 10 of chapter 10, the beginning of his, Nimrod's kingdom was Babel or Babylon, Erech, Arkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar. So let's just take a look at these cities on this map here. So we've got the Middle East, of course, the old Fertile Crescent. And these little towns here of Erech, Calneh, and Arkad, that's the land of Nimrod and called the land of Shinar. So the story of the Tower of Babel is happening there. And if you come to Daniel chapter 1, it says that they took the children of Israel across to the land of Shinar. So Daniel's based in this little red area called the land of Shinar. Now in verse 11 of this chapter, you'll see that those from Shem left Shinar, and it says in verse 11, out of that land, that is out of the land of Shinar, went forth Asher and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, and Calah. Now he's not a Hamite, he's from Shem in verse 22. So he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, and Calah. So let's just have a look at those. You'll see them up there in the northern Tigris Valley. So the Shemites moved up and settled the northern parts of that river valley. But there was one group of Shemites who went south, and that's the Elamites. So the Elamites, some of the descendants of Shem, went south, and they began to inherit that little river valley, fertile river flats here at the head of the Persian Gulf, and established the land of Elam. Now let's just keep in mind the Elamites, because they're going to be very important later on when it comes to the story of Babylon. So just keep two things in mind. Land of Shinar, this is where Book of Daniel is set. The Elamites are going to become very important later on in the book. And the Assyrians have got their empire up here in the north. So let's just keep those three things in mind as we go through. Now I want to spend about 6 or 7 minutes just describing to you what happened after this. Because what happened is as happens today, the peoples began to spread out across here and nations started becoming formed. People started to get together and families would begin to expand. They'd have children and grandchildren and they'd expand and they'd turn into these tribal groupings. And generally speaking, the more power people you have, the more power you have because you can fund and you can have more soldiers. So people ended up getting together in these little city-states, these little groups, on the basis of three or four main things. First, family, because, of course, blood's thicker than water, so you'd have children and families would form tribal groupings. Then they'd also all gather together into areas of food, right? So where there was a high availability of food, people would all sort of gather together, a bit like Christadelphians. You know where the food is? Because that's where everyone's all gathered together. Now, the third thing that caused people to clump together into groups is wealth. Now, you know, wealth is achieved through about four main sources. You either get wealth through resources. That's like the United States of America. You control vast resources of food, you know, of, in the early days, gold and of oil from Texas and of timber, and these are natural resources. And so a country can become wealthy, it can grow, people will attract to it because there's natural resources. A second one is you can trade or buy things, right? So you can buy things from one party, put your margin on, flog it off to someone other, and you become a merchant power. one of the famous merchant powers is the British Empire. Take stuff from one part of the world, move it over to another part of the world and make a big margin on it. The other thing is you can become a manufacturer. That means you're really, really good at making stuff. So you get resources off someone, you make things and you export them. Anyone know economies that were almost entirely built on becoming a manufacturer base? Two big ones in the world today, Japan, China. Don't know about here because the US is a bit more insular. But there was a time when just about everything had made in Japan on it. And then now just about everything has made in China on it. So it's a manufacturing base. Make stuff really cheap, really fast, really well. There was a fourth way of wealth accumulation. And that was simply go and steal and pillage it off someone else who's got it. So that's what happened in those days. All these little clumsy city-states, people began to move off across the empire there, clumped together in these little family groupings, tribal groupings. Wealth would attract more people. And before you knew it, they began to form little city-states. And we're going to call them little city-states because it's important to remember all these cities that you see sprinkled around, they've only got 20 to 50,000 people in them, so actually quite small. They'd all clumped together in these states and they built a little wall around themselves and they'd set up a little army. And they would have their own little farm plots around the side of it, sometimes little manufacturing inside, and then there'd be another one 10 miles down the road, there'd be another one across the river, and this whole area began to look like a bunch of city-states. And for about 1,000 years, all it was these city-states that were clumped together all the way throughout this Middle Eastern area. Now, if you look at this map here, you'll notice that there's something called the Syro-Arabian Desert. So once you started moving south of this line, it just turns into a really great big desert. No one lived there except sort of ragtag old sort of Bedouin people. You couldn't civilize that area in the sense that there was no water, there was no food, no resources. So no one lived in this desert area. If you go up to the top, you'll see the mountains. Right, very inhospitable, terrible place in winter. So it was only very tough people who moved up there to live. So almost all civilization started down here, moved up across the top, down through Israel, and down, if you see it, the Nile Valley. Anyone know what that was called? They call it today the Fertile Crescent, because it's sort of a crescent shape, and it became the cradle of ancient civilization as they settled those particular areas. But it was covered in these little city-states. Now, it's an interesting political state when you've got hundreds of these little city-states all lined up around the region because what starts to happen then, you've got a lot of alliances. So the city-state that was 10 miles away down the river, you'd form an alliance with, that if the city-state across the river came and attacked you, then they'd come up and help you. So you started getting these coalitions of little city-states. From time to time, a city-state would become weak. There'd be a famine, or there'd be internal strife and conflict inside it, or there'd be a disease or some change in economics. And what would then happen is the city-state down the river would come up, get into your city, sack you, kill the king, get rid of the aristocracy, capture the city, make it their own, and expand. So it's a bit like Age of Empires or any one of these sort of strategy games. That's what happened, all right? Just people trying to accumulate wealth and trying to accumulate city-states and become bigger and bigger. Now, there was one particular custom. They worked out pretty early on that if you form alliances, then that gives you more power and leverage over someone else. And one of the very best ways of setting up an alliance is to marry the sister or daughter or cousin of the king in the next city-state. It's a good idea for two reasons. One is because probably he's more likely to like you if you've married a sister or daughter. And the other thing is sister and daughter's now inside your city with you. So if he attacks, then guess what happens to his sister or daughter? So you ended up with this funny little coalition. And what would happen, you'd have this whole palace sitting inside the city. And there might be up to hundreds of wives that he'd married from lots of city states. Remember Solomon? All the wives and concubines he had? Almost all of those are political alliances to make sure that other cities and other countries and other towns wouldn't come and fight you. So nice insurance policy. So you should be thankful all those girls who weren't living in those days because that's what you were. You're an insurance policy for your dad, the king. Now, every one of the city-states has its own tribal god, right? So the tribe had arrived, they had their own little god. Often families had their own ancestral gods, but there were thousands and thousands of gods and goddesses that people had throughout this area. But there were only two or three major gods that everybody in the whole realm worshipped. And the amazing thing was that they all came originally out of Babylon. So we're going to have a look in a moment who they were, the big major gods and goddesses that everybody worshipped and why. But they all trace their origins back to the founding of Babel, Genesis 11, Nimrod, and in Babylon. Now, the reason why we're looking at this is because it's important to understand that Babylon, which is just sitting here, was for most of its history just one of these city-states. It wasn't that important. In fact, it went through the hands of eight different nationalities. So eight different nationalities at different times came and sacked it, took it, and made it their own town. So by the time we get to Daniel, Nimrod, the Hamites, are gone. They're long gone. They've all been assimilated now into the peoples of Babylon, and it's a very different sort of a city. But one thing Babylon never changed through all of that time was its religion. It always maintained the worship of what they call Marduk, the supreme god, throughout that entire time. We'll hopefully have a look at him in a few moments. So Babylon literally became, for the Mesopotamian earth, the mother of harlots and abominations. It was the center from which all the idolatrous worship emanated. Now, I want to talk quickly about the Chaldeans, because you'll remember in the book of Daniel, we read about the Chaldeans quite frequently. And the Babylonians are associated with Chaldeans. In fact, later on, the Babylonians become synonymous with Chaldeans. But they weren't originally called Babylonians. They were Elamites. Right? So they lived down here in the area of Elam, the area that became known as the area of the Kaldu, hence the Chaldeans. So they inhabited that little black little area there called the Kaldu, a subsector of the Elamites. And originally a very obscure, very little heard of people, you see, because Chaldean, anyone know what Chaldean means? It means literally a breaker of clay, a clod breaker, because they're agriculture, they're farmers. They used to go out there with their mattocks and break the clods of clay, and people would look at them and go, look at those people breaking clods of clay, why don't we call them Chaldeans? And that's why they were called the Kaldu. They broke clods of clay. They're also farmers, so you'll see down there very well-watered plains down there in Elam. They became farmers, and they became focused on agriculture and farming, and so their great god was called Nana. Nana, the god of the cows. So, also later on became the god of the moon. So that was the patron god of the area of the Kaldu. Now, interesting, Ur was in the area of the Kaldu, the Elamites, particularly the Eberites, later on became known as the Hebrews, and that's where Abraham lived. So Abraham was part of the pastoral community, the agriculturalists, the Kaldu or Elamites down there in that land in Ur, and their great god was the god of the cows and the god of the moon. And you remember that it says Abraham and his family had worshipped gods in the other side of the river Euphrates and left them. These are the gods that they left. Now, the Kaldu began to grow more and more powerful because, of course, you can see Elam. It's right on the river. So river trade had to come up through their country and land. They could tax it. They could control the river trade as it went up towards the area of Shinar and up into Assyria itself. And they started becoming very, very wealthy. And one of these, as we said, powerful city-states that arose was Ur. The other one was this little town here called Larsa. Now, I want to show you something interesting. It's my brick, all right? About 3 years ago, no, it'd be longer than that. When did the Iraq war start? Anyone know what year it was? Could be 2001, 2002, so it's been going for 10 years nearly. All right. As you'll know, there was a terrible event here known as September 11, and as a result of that, the United States, plus a bunch of coalition forces, including New Zealand, although New Zealand sent two or three rowboats, I think, invaded Iraq. So modern day Iraq essentially covers this whole area through here, ancient Babylon, and this lower area here of ancient Ur, of the Kaldu and the Elamites. So there was an invasion of Iraq. Now what happened? Remember shock and awe? Remember that? It's just like sort of dump everything the United States got in one place and go and go and invade. Now what that happened, it created anarchy, of course, for about 8 weeks in Iraq. Probably still is a bit anarchic there. And everyone went and looted the museums. So there were all sorts of ancient artifacts in the museums in Iraq, and of course the locals went in and looted them because there was no law and order. And you could go onto eBay and buy genuine 3,000-year-old Babylonian bricks with writing and stuff on them for $50. But it's stolen goods, right? So you can't really do that. But what that did is it caused a plummet in the value of the real of the stuff that was legal. I say legal, what it basically was is the English and the Germans came across in Iraq back in the 1800s and they looted the country and took all the stuff back, right? But it was legal and it ended up in a variety of collections back in Europe. But it was legal. It had what they call provenance. You could prove that it was legally taken because back in those days the British actually controlled that area. So that gave them the right to nick stuff. Well, anyway, what happened, I thought, well, hey, this is a good opportunity to see if you can buy an actual genuine Babylonian brick with cuneiform on it at really cheap prices, because the real ones did. So I online entered an auction in London, at Christie's, the auction house, and actually bought this thing. Now, it's amazing, because this little brick, and then they shipped it over to me in New Zealand. Normally I'd take it with me if I'm doing this study, but I figured coming in through LA Airport with that in my luggage, they'd go, what's that? Where'd it come from? And they'd probably take it off me. So it's still back at home. But let me tell you what it's about. Amazing little thing. Anyone here read cuneiform? Let's do a zoom in of it, all right? They didn't have writing materials. I'll tell you why they didn't. If you look at this map, this is desert. These are massive river plains, a bit like the plains of the United States, prairie country. There's no trees, so you can't really make paper. No one really knew how to make paper, anyone those days. And the skins of the animals are way too valuable to use to write on because you need them to build houses and tents and for clothing. So there's no writing material. So what they did is they got clay. Mix it together with a straw, press it out, and then with a little stylus, a little wooden, sort of with a cut-off straight piece at the end, you'd make little impressions of lines in it. And that's their writing, ancient cuneiform, probably the most ancient form of writing that's been discovered. And so that actually says something. Anyone read it? See what it says? This is why I bought it. I thought it was pretty cool. The other reason I bought it is because it wasn't that long ago people were saying that the Bible's not true because it talks about Babylon and no such place ever existed because no one's found it, and if it was there, then you should have found it. And it wasn't there. You go to the River Euphrates, go up and down it. Babylon, River Euphrates went through the middle of Babylon, so you should be able to find ancient Babylon, but it wasn't there. Until an archaeologist heard some stories from some Bedouin about a city out in the desert. And when they went out and had a look at it, sure enough, there was this massive city, but it was underneath the sands because of the sands had all blown over the top of it. It was quite a few miles, about 10 miles away from the River Euphrates. So it couldn't be Babylon. As they began to dig, they started to find bricks like this. And the amazing thing is, it's actually got the name of Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon written in cuneiform on the brick. And what happened is the rivers actually moved over the last 2,000 years, and Babylon ended up a long way from the River Euphrates, but it used to flow through the middle of it, so they discovered it. This is what it says. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, provisioner of Ezekiel and Zeda, prime son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon am I. Ebabaka, the temple of Shamash and Larsa, I restored as it was before for Shamash my lord. So I thought it was pretty cool. You know, so I use this in a public lecture where people can come up and I don't let them touch it. It's in a nice little glass box. But to actually see Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon's name written on these bricks, because what he did, being a very humble sort of a guy, whenever he built a temple to one of his gods, he would inscribe or stamp. You can see there's a marker, a line around the edge of it. This was actually made on a wooden stamp, and he would stamp all the main bricks as they went, as they built them, and then make the temple out of it. So you can find these buried in the desert. That is from a place called Larsa, if we go back to our map, which is here, only about 10 miles away from ancient Ur, where Abraham lived. And it mentions a couple of key things that we'll pick up in a moment. It mentions the temple of Marduk in Babylon, Ezagil. So the main ziggurat temple in Babylon was called Ezagil. There was top of it, there was a chapel called the Chapel of Nabu or Azida. He was the son of the main god of Marduk in Babylon. Ebbekah became the name of a temple or ziggurat dedicated to Shamash. Shamash was the sun god of ancient Babylonia, and also called Utu. Last, of course, was a city. So what we've got here in this little brick is actually a real brick inscribed by Babylon, or by Nebuchadnezzar, by his command, as he built this temple to the sun god down there in Larsa. Now, interestingly, when I had this shipped across, because I had to do it all very delicately, it took 3 weeks to turn up from London, where I bought it from. It turned up at work, and all the guys were saying, "Oh, what's that box on your desk?" And I said, "Oh, I'll show you." And I opened it up and showed them, and they were going, "Wow, what does it say?" And I said, "Well, it says this." And then I just left it sitting in a little glass box on my desk for a couple of weeks. And after a while, one of the guys came and says, "Oh, can you sort of take that away?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you know, I don't think Shamash is probably going to be very happy about sitting on your desk, and it's making me feel uncomfortable, so can you take it away?" And I thought, that's quite funny. You know, people are still a little bit superstitious. They said, "You nicked this out of the temple of Shamash, the sun god in Babylon. You know, we're a bit frightened here in Brisbane, Australia, that he's going to come and get us." So that's a quick little background. Right, where are we up to? Okay, so that's pretty much life for about 1,000 years as we move up into the time of Abraham. Abraham is native, of course, to that lower part here that's now called the land of the Chaldeans, living in Ur, down in the land of the Elamites. Now, what happened over this time? City-states began to coalesce more and more and more, and there was a group of them, up there in the north in Assyria that became more and more powerful. They were more vicious than everybody else, better at warfare, and they coalesced more and more, and essentially they became the first empire. And you ended up with the Assyrian group of people having the domination over the empire. Now, we normally read about the Assyrian Empire, of course, in terms of the nation of Israel. So we read about Assyria in the Bible itself. But Assyria actually ruled all of that purple area for about 600 years. And Babylon, for about 600 years, was actually just a sub-city within the Assyrian Empire. Very important from a religious point of view, but not particularly powerful. In fact, Babylon was a bit of a bolshy sort of a state. It rebelled against the Assyrians 6 different times. It got destroyed and burnt to the ground 4 times by the Assyrians, and then they went and rebuilt it. So the history of Babylon is quite an adventurous one. Well, what I want to do, I want to move right forward now into the last 80 years of the Assyrian Empire, because now we're going to start getting down to about the time when Daniel's going to turn up and the Chaldeans are going to come to power in Babylon. Remember the Chaldeans right down here? They're the moon worshippers. They worship the god of the cows. They're agriculturalists, but they've become quite powerful down there because they controlled the trade routes. The Assyrians are right up in the top. They control Babylon, but Babylon's been a bit bolshy. They've sacked it a few times, burnt it and rebuilt it. But gradually, the Chaldean power is becoming more and more powerful down there in the south. So we move forward to the last 80 years of the Assyrian Empire, where they've been going. They've been ruling this area now for about 600 years. And there's a chappie called Merodach Baladan who's reigning in Babylon. All right, so he's He's a Babylonian king, but he's ruled over by the Assyrians, who are the actual power. And he begins to plot against the power of Assyria. Now, come over to Isaiah chapter 39, because we actually read of this chappy. He's a king, Merodach-Baladan, king of Babylon. He's in subjection to the Assyrians, but he's going to start forming alliances with the Chaldeans and trying to get rid of the Assyrians. And what this chappy did is he sent little secret spy embassies out to all the different powers and nations around the Assyrian Empire, very quietly, secretly, to see if he could get their help. And Isaiah 39 is the story of when the embassy from this king of Babylon, still under the Assyrians, sends off to Hezekiah, king of Judah, a little present and a special letter. So Isaiah 39 verse 1, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah because he heard he'd been sick and was recovered. And Hezekiah was glad, and he showed the embassy the house of all his precious things. Because of this, in verse 5, Isaiah the prophet says to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord, or Yahweh of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house, all which your fathers have laid up in store to this day, shall be carried to Babylon, nothing left." Verse 7, "Your sons that shall issue from thee thou shalt beget, they shall take away and be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." That's fulfilled in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. But it all started back in the days of Assyria, where a sub-king in Babylon sent an embassy. He didn't really care about Hezekiah. What he was doing was trying to build his connections to other city-states to try and become more powerful and take on the Assyrians. So that's the first time we really hear of the king of Babylon related to the story of Daniel, because many years later, they heard about the riches, they come back again to try and take them. All right, Merodach-Baladan carried on this for about 5 years, sending little stories out, little letters out and presents out to all the different city-states round about. And about 5 years later, Sennacherib, king of Assyrians, came down, and he totally wiped out Babylon. He killed Merodach-Baladan. He burnt the whole thing down to the ground. He diverted the river around, so it was gone. So, amazing thing, that only 5 years after Hezekiah had received this embassy from Merodach, Babylon disappeared entirely. The Assyrians wiped it out. They said, "Look, we had a gut full of this. You're trying to create an insurrection, we're going to wipe you out." But some interesting things started to happen. About 15 years after the Assyrians had wiped out Babylon, they were beginning to move across the west and down here into the land of Israel. And remember in the story about 10 to 15 years later of Sennacherib and his army came down to Jerusalem to siege it. And through the prayers of Hezekiah and his faithfulness to the people, God actually wiped out the army. So it says they woke up in the morning, looked out, and they were all dead corpses. And so the Assyrian army all packed up and started to head back home. When Sennacherib got back home to Assyria, his two sons, who obviously loved him very much, executed him in the temple of his god. And his youngest son, called Esarhaddon, was placed on the throne by the council of Assyria in his stead. But that was just the beginning of a whole lot of problems. They wiped out half their army down here in Jerusalem, disappeared. Plague started to happen, famines began to arise in Assyria, and about 5 years later, you know what all the aristocracy of Assyria decided had caused it? They thought it was because they wiped out Babylon, because back in Babylon was the great temple to Marduk, the king of Babel, of ancient Mesopotamia, and because they wiped him out, they thought he was trying to get them back. So they went back down to Babylon, they rebuilt the whole of Babylon from scratch again. But it didn't work, because about 40 years later, Assyria imploded into a civil war, and you ended up with this attempted invasion by, if you look up the top there, somebody called the Scythians. Anyone here at all got Russian or Eastern European forebears? No? All right, that was the ancient Scythians, all right? Very wild bunch who lived up there in the mountains. But because the Assyrians had now imploded in the civil war, they tried to invade the nation of Israel and throughout the Middle East. And if I just have a quick look at this, Oh, yeah, okay. So the Scythians came down, tried to invade the ancient Assyrian Empire, but there's another group here, the Elamites and the Persians, who then went up and cut off the Scythians up in their mountain passes so they couldn't get back, and a power vacuum arose. And for the very first time in that power vacuum, a king from Chaldea migrated up to Babylon, captured it, and set himself up as king. Right, so that's really the story of the Chaldean Babylon that the Book of Daniel's sitting in, was the establishment of a Chaldean Babylon in this power vacuum as the Assyrian Empire began to implode, as he went up there to Babylon and established himself. Now, what I'm going to do now very quickly on the map is animate for you and show you how the Babylonians actually took the empire off the Assyrians and then just essentially replicated all their religion. We've said already that in this power vacuum there was a Chaldean revolt against the Assyrians. They were also already pretty powerful because they had accumulated a lot of wealth from their trade. And they marched up to Babylon and fought the Assyrians who were in power there and took it and captured it and established one of their own as the first Chaldean king. Now, his name is very important. The king who marched on Babylon and took it was called Nabopolassar. And Nabopolassar is going to be Nebuchadnezzar's dad. Very important to the story of Babylon. So Nabopolassar, the first Chaldean king of Babylon, has the son called Nebuchadnezzar, who, as all good fathers, says, "Son, you're going to be the general of my army." So Nebuchadnezzar, who we know as the king, at first was the general of the king of the Chaldean army, appointed by his father, Nabopolassar, who had sacked and taken Babylon. So that's where Nebuchadnezzar started. Actually a brilliant general, very clever fighting man in his early days. And he led the Chaldean army then up here against Asshur, or Assyria itself. He also brought in from the side there the Medes. The Medes joined him with their army from out there in the east, and they fought the Assyrian army right in their heartland in Assyria. Now, it's there that they won the war and they broke the back of the Assyrian power, and the Assyrian army then fled from Asher up to a little town there called, if I've got it here, Nineveh. All right, so Nineveh was the other principal city of the Assyrians they fled to. Nebuchadnezzar plus the Median army with Nebuchadnezzar in charge of the general chased them up to Nineveh and beat them then again. So the army fled even further all the way over here to Haran, very famous place we know of because Abraham, of course, and his family stopped there and fought them again. And by this point, then the army of Assyria fled again to a little place called, we'll just leave it there, Haran. So the army's just been taken over in Haran. Now, way down here in Egypt are the Egyptians and Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh had an alliance with the Assyrians that if anything happens to you, then we will help each other out. So by now, the Egyptian king's starting to get a bit worried because the Chaldean power and Medians have now very quickly, only over a few years, taken the ancient Assyrians. We've got a few minutes left. Good. So they've taken the ancient Assyrian Empire. Pharaoh's down here. He's starting to get really worried about this. He says, well, hang on. It used to be stable. There's this new power now arisen. We don't have any alliance with it. We better get up there as quick as we can. So the Pharaoh down in Egypt puts his armies together and he starts to move north. But to get north, guess which country you have to go through? Land of Israel. So he takes his army and he marches it up through the land of Israel, up between the Lebanese mountains to a place called Carchemish, where a famous battle is going to take place in a few minutes. So why this is interesting, though, is this. There's a whole lot going on in the land of Israel that we know about because it's all recorded in the Bible. Who's the king sitting on the throne of Judah at this particular point? Anyone know? Assyrian Empire has just imploded. Chaldeans have now risen up against the Assyrians because they can. They've taken Babylon. Nabopolassar is now the king, but his son Nebuchadnezzar is a general. He's aligned with the Medians. They've taken Asher, taken Nineveh, beaten them at Haran. Syrian Empire is now gone. The Chaldeans are beginning to spread across the area. Pharaoh's getting worried down here. Egypt, he's on his way up to try and fight them. And he goes to the land of Israel. And who's there? Josiah. Young King Josiah is on the throne. And what are you going to do if you're Josiah? Pharaoh Necho's on his way from the south, marching north. He's going to come through your country to attack to the north. What are you going to do? Well, you know what he does? He takes his army out against them. And he takes them out and meets them at Megiddo. So you might just see there Josiah killed in battle. Remember, he was told not to. It's actually told the prophets, Josiah, don't go out in war or battle against Pharaoh. And why was he told that by the prophet? Because in the big purpose of God, what was going on? The power of Assyria was going. The power of the Babylonians was about to start. He'd made a prophecy that Babylon was going to come across and take all the young princes and kings and people back to Babylon. And Pharaoh Necho's supposed to go up there. So Josiah was told, don't go out against them. Well, he does. And in the end, Josiah ends up dead. We won't turn that up, but if you want to take a note, 2 Chronicles 35 has got that whole story. So getting to Megiddo, Pharaoh Necho brushes aside Josiah. Josiah is dead now, and he starts marching up to the Battle of Carchemish. And in 605 BC, a very famous ancient battle takes place there up at Carchemish. You'll see it there. And that's where Nebuchadnezzar, the general of the Babylonian army, ends up defeating both the remnants of the Assyrians and also Pharaoh Necho's army. So very, very quickly, the picture I'm trying to portray here is very quickly, inside only 10 years, the whole world changed. Syria was gone, the power of Babylon and the Chaldean Babylon arose. Pharaoh Necho was annihilated, and he began to head back home. But guess what happened? Nebuchadnezzar chased them all the way back down through Lebanon, back down through the land, and then blocked them off here and barracked him back in the land of Egypt. So when we read of the first time Nebuchadnezzar came into the land of Israel, he's actually chasing Pharaoh Necho back into Egypt after defeating him at Carchemish. And that's how the Bible record now starts coming to the text through the time of Josiah and the first exile of the Jews. So Daniel and his three friends are taken into exile. They're captured by Nebuchadnezzar, who at that point's the general, not the king, in the land of Israel, and are taken back then to Babylon. And it's all happened in this small little period of about 10 years. All right, we'll just very quickly wrap this up. What Nebuchadnezzar didn't do is he set a couple of vassals in place. So if you recall from the Bible point of view, Jehoiakim then became king of Judah. And in the scriptures it says that Jehoiakim, because Nebuchadnezzar had gone back to Babylon, began to cozy up with Pharaoh Necho again. After a few years, this annoyed Nebuchadnezzar so much that he sent a second army back down in again and sacked the land again, a second time. And this carried on, of course, all the way through the time of Zedekiah, when there was the second great exile. Let's just see whether we've got some other things. All right. In 1 minute, let's just very quickly summarise then what we're looking at. Amazingly, the Empire of Babylon that we've just looked at only lasted for 86 years. So, in conclusion, I think we'll just quickly run through this. At the top there, you've got Nabopolassar. We're going to call him Grandad, all right? So he's the guy who came up from the land of the Chaldeans and sacked Babylon, took it. His son Nebuchadnezzar, the general of the army, he's the one who defeated the Assyrians, joined with the Medes, beat Pharaoh Necho, came down to land, exiled back Daniel and his friends and the others of Judah back to Babylon. But when he got back, his father died and he became the king of Babylon and he reigned for 43 years. So the story of the book of Daniel up to chapter 5 all happens in this little period of 43 years when Nebuchadnezzar the general has become the son. When he died, his grandson, called Evil-Merodach, actually ended up reigning for about 2 years. He wasn't very good, so they sort of got rid of him and executed him, which is what happened if you're no good. And his brother-in-law, in other words, Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law, reigned for about 5 years before he too was then executed, got off the throne, and an entirely new dynasty ruled by Nabonidus and Belshazzar then came to power. So remember the story of Daniel where the hand was writing on the wall and there was a king Belshazzar? Well, that was a second dynasty. It didn't really have much to do with Nebuchadnezzar at all. So there, in a quick 50 minutes, you've got the historic snapshot of Babylon over about 3,200 years. So hopefully, we went very quickly there. Hopefully that's giving a little bit of picture of the dynamics that are going on in the politics and of the Middle East at the time of Daniel.